Almost everybody grows up wanting to do something they love, to be successful at it, and to be happy in life. That was how our next guest felt. She was at the top of her professional game, she was respected in her field, and she enjoyed what she was doing. But then she saw problems. The corporate numbers didn't add up. She did the right thing, but nobody would listen. Things didn't go well, and all of a sudden she was famous. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Sharon Watkins is the kind of person that we all should aspire to be like. She's educated, honest, and successful. She graduated from the University of Texas with an honors degree in business administration and then earned a master's degree in accounting from the school. And soon after that, she became a certified public accountant. Sharon went on to work for the professional services firm Arthur Andersen as an auditor, and then she spent several years on Wall Street managing a portfolio of commodity-backed financial assets. She joined the energy giant Enron in 1993 and became its vice president of corporate development there. In 2001, Sharon realized that Enron's financial numbers just didn't add up. She investigated and then warned Chief Executive Officer Kenneth Lay about the accounting irregularities that she found in the company's financial statements. But Lay, as it turned out, was up to his neck in the scandal. 5 years later, he was convicted on 10 counts of securities fraud, although he died of a heart attack before he could be imprisoned. Sharon Watkins, for her part, assumed a place in the pantheon of the most important whistleblowers in modern American history. She found evidence of illegality and she reported it. She testified on Capitol Hill, she wrote a book about her experiences, and she was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year in 2002, along with two other whistleblowers. Sharon Watkins is now a highly sought-after speaker on whistleblowing and business ethics, and we're happy to welcome her to the show. Sharon, it's good to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, John, and thank you for all the flattering comments. It's nice to be on your program.
They're all true, and thanks for joining us. There are so many things that I want to ask you about, but let's begin with the fundamentals for those of our viewers who are not familiar with your work. You were a senior executive at Enron, one of the biggest energy, commodities, and services companies in the world. You found accounting irregularities, and you reported those irregularities to then-CEO Ken Lay. Tell us about that and about what happened next.
Well, I had stumbled across this horrible accounting fraud in the summer of 2001, and my first reaction was to dust off my resume and try to leave the company, because I did feel as if it might be fruitless to speak to the CEO at the time, Jeff Skilling. But in August, mid-August, he surprisingly quit. He had been chief operating officer since 97. In 2001, he'd taken over as CEO, the job he'd wanted for decades, or at least a decade. And 8 months later, he's quitting, and for no good reason. And I really felt like it was a chance to maybe right the ship, that Ken Lay was chairman of the board, but he was stepping back in as CEO. And hey, maybe I had the real reason Jeff Skilling was leaving. The company was going to implode in a wave of accounting scandal, and the captain of the ship needed to know about it.
Wow. One of the things that I recall about the Enron scandal was that Wall Street loved the company right up until the point that it fell apart. And I remember that it fell apart very quickly. Take us back to that. You knew that things were coming to a head. You tried to make corrections and to bring the problems up your chain of command. At first, the outside world had no idea that any of this was happening. What was it like at Enron when the news finally broke?
The whole thing, I like to use the Titanic as an example. So, you know, I'm a crew member. I know we've hit an iceberg, water's pouring in. That's kind of equivalent to my accounting knowledge, that you just, it's very hard to recover from cooking your books. And these were massive numbers. It was a manipulation of half of our earnings in the year 2000. So this was a significant manipulation. And so I'm like the crew member warning the captain. And you expect, you know, the alarm bells going off, the lifeboats lowering, business lines being saved, hoard cash. You know, what's the crisis management team, you know, planning on doing? And instead, people just ignored the problem or kind of focused on, hey, aren't we the Titanic? We're unsinkable. Let's just look back at our plans iceberg shouldn't be a problem for us. Merrill Lynch had us as a strong buy in early October of 2001, and we declared bankruptcy December 2nd. We went fast. I mean, it is kind of similar to Silicon Valley Bank. You know, when people get nervous that you're not going to be around, there is sort of the run on the bank. And that is what happened at Enron as well, but more in our trading accounts, where we had large deposits or large, really, liabilities on the trading side. And those customers closed out their accounts and requested their money. And that's what put us in crisis.
And we're talking about huge amounts of money here. I was looking at the numbers last night just to sort of refresh my memory. And we're talking about a company that was worth more than $100 billion and was really seen as a global leader in energy.
Yes. Enron had started its life as a natural gas pipeline company in North America, but it morphed into a financial trading powerhouse here in the United States, trading gas, oil, electricity, even broadband and weather derivatives. But internationally, we were building power plants and pipelines in developing countries. And Ken Lay, our chairman and long-term CEO, had really taken pride in our green energy development around the globe.
You eventually gave very powerful testimony on Capitol Hill. You said that you had warned Ken Lay that he was being deceived by several senior executives, including Jeffrey Skilling, the former COO and CEO, and Andrew Fastow, the former chief financial officer. Ken Lay seemed to be very concerned at the time, and you recommended that he go public with the information and face the consequences, whatever the consequences were that the market might put up. But he didn't do that, and in the end, he, Skilling, and Fastow were all prosecuted. How can something like this happen in a company as enormous as Enron, where presumably there are internal and external auditors, accountants, attorneys, all working to ensure the exact opposite, that this never happens?
Right. Well, I bring up another analogy, the emperor's new clothes. I mean, that 140-year-old fable is not really a children's tale. It's about human behavior. And Jeff Skilling was very intimidated. You know, we've hired the sharpest accountants, bankers in the country. You know, you're really going to keep asking questions and prove you don't get it. Arthur Andersen, I think, was intimidated going along for the large fees Enron was paying them, $52 million a year to audit Enron's books. But even the banks went along. Citibank, Chase, and CIBC settled shareholder litigation for their dealings with Enron for $2 billion apiece, because they were lending money to Enron, but they knew Enron was booking it as free cash flow. So there's almost this sort of safety in numbers. Like, well, if the banks keep lending, they must be doing their due diligence. They know it's not a risky client. If Andersen keeps approving it, they're a big, well-respected auditing firm. It must be okay. So it kind of reminds me of FTX, where it's not really Andersen or, you know, the big banks. It's more the celebrities that were touting FTX. So in the age of Kim Kardashian, you know, the reality TV, you don't need Andersen, you don't need Citibank, Chase, you just need celebrities to tout that you're okay. And people almost conclude that, well, these kind of organizations wouldn't be involved with a fraud. Well, you know, they were.
No, I was at Deloitte & Touche when much of this played out. I had left the CIA and gone into the private sector. And there was a ripple effect here, a very important ripple effect. The collapse of Enron also brought the collapse of Arthur Andersen, which at the time was the biggest and most important professional services firm in the world. And there were literally thousands of equity partners at Andersen that, you know, one day were making millions of dollars a year and the next day were in the unemployment line. A lot of people were hurt by this.
A lot of people were. And I felt particularly sorry for the retired Arthur Andersen partners, because their pensions were in a partnership that were not bankruptcy proof. So, you know, they were in their 70s, retired, and they just lost all their retirement, unable to really go back to work. Same thing happens with Enron employees that had their 401k invested in Enron stock. And Enron shareholders lost stock worth $60 billion at the beginning of 2001. But it did have ripple effects on, you know, many of our customers that had margin deposits on hold with us. It was pretty brutal.
Yeah, that's tough. Jeffrey Skilling served more than 12 years in prison. Andrew Fastow served more than 5 years in prison. Between them and the estate of Ken Lay, they forfeited tens of millions of dollars in the case. Was justice served, in your view? Certainly the company's principals were punished, but what about the shareholders? After all, there were people, as you just said a moment ago, who lost everything when Enron collapsed. Were they ever made whole again?
No one was made whole. There was like $9 or $10 billion collected, and shareholders that bought shares from 98 forward got, you know, maybe 15, 20 cents on the dollar for their loss. But for many employees, if they'd been at the company and earned stock options and stock grants in the late 80s or early 90s, they didn't receive anything from that shareholder lawsuit. So it was pretty brutal. But I will say, you know, it's been 20 years since Enron collapsed. I've met a lot of whistleblowers. And there is a sense that justice was meted out. The very top executives were found guilty. They were sent to prison. And there are so many whistleblowers that still have a lot of angst because the people that did the wrongdoing, the higher ups, they got away with it. They went home rich. You know, they might not even be disgraced, just kind of known for being poor leaders or ran their companies into the ground. But there's a lot of frustration for people who speak truth to power and don't see justice happen. And in the Enron case, people are able to move on and leave it because justice was served with those prison terms.
We are speaking with Enron whistleblower Sharon Watkins. We have a lot more to talk about, so stay with us through this commercial break. We're going to be right back.
Counter the Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
С учетом того, что на Украине с 2014 года шла гражданская война, для черной трансплантологии Украина стала это просто золотым дном.
Это Израиль, это Германия, Канада, Франция. Они очень заинтересованы в украинцах, потому что это дешевый материал, платить много не надо.
Там были найдены тела, которые вот находились без органов.
Бойцов скрывали на линии боевого соприкосновения.
Когда будет произведена демилитаризация Украины, будет военный трибунал, будет отдельное слушание по черным трансплантологам. Большой и очень серьезный судебный процесс.
We're speaking with Enron whistleblower Sharon Watkins about her experience trying to head off what at the time was the greatest corporate failure in American history. Sharon, you were lauded by members of both parties on Capitol Hill for your whistleblowing, your honesty, and your pursuit of transparency. That's highly unusual. And honestly, I can't even imagine it happening in many cases in today's political environment here in Washington. But one of the complaints that I had from my time on Capitol Hill was that even after successful and important public hearings, there was usually little or no follow-up. Was that your experience on Capitol Hill? Did anything good come out of those hearings? New legislation, new regulations, more transparency?
Well, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act was passed in the summer of 2002 in the wake of the failures at Enron and WorldCom and Global Crossing, other corporate meltdowns. And it did do some good. It codified best practices for boards of directors, that boards needed to have a certain level of independence. They needed to have the right expertise on the board, and they needed to meet without management present, really hoping to increase dialogue and discussion on corporate boards. They also implemented an anti-retaliation provision that internal whistleblowers couldn't be fired or reprimanded. And that had its, you know, bumps in the road, but that was good legislation. It required internal controls to be beefed up, and that CEOs they couldn't use the defense of, well, I'm not an accountant. You know, they had to certify that their financial statements were not misleading. So that was some good efforts. I think I often think it's because of 9/11 that we were not able to immediately capture Osama bin Laden. And it's like the whole mood within this country was, well, if we can't get the international folks, let's get the domestic guys that are doing wrong.
Mm-hmm. Sharon, oftentimes these cases drag on for many years. It took about 5 years to bring Enron's senior executives to justice, and it took about 15 years for Enron to finally cease to exist. That's not unusual. And it's not unusual for very important people to be caught up in these kinds of cases. One of the people who is no stranger to litigation, and this may sound kind of funny to some of our viewers, but it's former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney. When he was a sitting vice president in 2004, he took to the courts to protect himself from fallout from his contact with Ken Lay. Cheney met with Lay in early 2001, and he met with other oil company executives, an environmental group, the Sierra Club, and a conservative watchdog group, Judicial Watch, sued Cheney, arguing that the energy task force that Cheney headed was subject to a 1972 law that required the disclosure of the work of advisory groups that included non-federal employees. What happened in that case? Was the outcome good for whistleblowers and for transparency, or no?
Well, it was not good for transparency. That went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they ruled that those minutes of those Energy Task Force meetings could be held confidential and classified. And John, it really brings up a good point. And I realized that, you know, it was called an Energy Task Force, and Ken Lay of Enron ended up meeting with Dick Cheney six times in 2001. But what I remember was that in December and January, as Enron declared bankruptcy and, you know, there was all this concern about Enron's and Ken Lay's ties to President Bush and the former President Bush, people thought Ken Lay must have requested bailout help. There were media inquiries into that Cheney meetings, thinking Enron was requesting bailouts. Well, you know, Ken Lay was really kind of clueless that we were in such financial hardships, that we were about to implode in a wave of accounting schemes. So I know he wasn't requesting bailout help because he didn't realize he needed it. But Cheney was really adamant that these things remain confidential. And to this day, I believe Cheney held discussions about Iraq that would indicate possibly, you know, Cheney's viewpoint that we were going to invade Iraq before 9/11, because these task force meetings, most of them happened before 9/11. And I think there's evidence in those minutes that there was a strong inclination that we might need some of our energy companies involved in the industry in Iraq. And, you know, I really want to see those minutes see the light of day.
And let's add to that. Ken Lay was the former national chairman of the, or one of the national chairmen of the George W. Bush presidential campaign in the year 2000. Ken Lay was a major fundraiser for the Bush-Cheney campaign in 2000. We know that Ken Lay and Dick Cheney were friends. We know that Dick Cheney had a special interest in energy, as you note correctly, before 9/11. Well, if there's nothing to be ashamed of, then why not release the minutes?
Right. I was very alarmed at how hard he fought for those to remain quiet. And given that we started the Iraq War in March of 2003 under false pretenses of weapons of mass destruction and ties to 9/11, I think that's why he fought so hard, because you know, there was going to be evidence that it was in their plan prior to 9/11.
One other thing on this Dick Cheney situation, and maybe I'm getting a little too far afield, but I think it's worth raising. We know that in the final days of the Bush administration, Dick Cheney lobbied President Bush hard for a handful of pardons, the most important of which was Scooter Libby, Cheney's former chief of staff. I'm actually surprised that Cheney didn't weigh in on behalf of Ken Lay. They had been friends for years, decades even. They were involved in energy at the same time. And Ken Lay never got any relief.
No, I think Cheney and Bush both could read the tea leaves and realize that the mood in the country was against, you know, corporate CEOs that had run their companies into the ground. And there was no cabinet position offered to Ken Lay. There was no amnesty offered to Ken Lay.
Right, exactly. Sharon, you recently gave a very interesting interview to the National Whistleblower Center that I want to ask you about. Psychologists who deal with whistleblower issues tell us that it is very rare for a whistleblower to find success after they blow the whistle on waste, fraud, and abuse. In fact, very, very few whistleblowers ever make a financial comeback. Many lose friends, and in many cases, even their marriages break up. But none of that has happened to you. Your experience has been completely different. To what do you attribute your continuing success, and what advice would you give somebody considering blowing the whistle?
Well, I'm very happy with the reward for programs in the Dodd-Frank Act that passed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, because that does allow a whistleblower to find legal support, because there's a way potentially to pay for that legal support when a reward is given. And it also keeps whistleblowers anonymous. And for me, I don't make the same amount of money I would have with a corporate career. And the corporate career is closed off, and I have lost friends. But I am a person of faith, and I've relied on that faith. And it's come through for me in the sense that, you know, I'm fairly content. And I live with a lot of uncertainty. I do make a living giving speeches, and there's just no certainty as to when those will happen and when they won't. But I've become comfortable with that uncertainty and, you know, have been really enjoying being able to advocate for whistleblowers and the programs that support them.
Sharon, tell us a little bit about your cooperation with the National Whistleblower Center and other whistleblower groups around the world. And just as importantly, tell us where our viewers can learn more about the work that you do.
I write sometimes for the Whistleblower Network News, but I am a proponent, and really I want to get the word out on the whistleblower programs that exist through Dodd-Frank and the different laws that have been passed even recently, anti-money laundering. There are now, you know, several law firms that support whistleblowers, and they can remain anonymous. But as I speak around the globe, and certainly in North America, audiences seem to still be unaware of the avenues they have to speak truth to power. And so I like to get the word out. I ask audiences a question. How much do you think the SEC has paid out to whistleblowers in the first 10 years of the whistleblower program that the Dodd-Frank Act initiated? And their guesses are way low. You know, it's over $1 billion. The SEC is a whole new animal. These programs work. They're a check and balance against abuse of power, and it is truly helping organizations behave correctly and look for corruption themselves and ferret it out themselves. Because if they do wrong, there are way too many avenues now where someone can blow the whistle. It is getting better, you know, for corporate whistleblowers in the private sector. I think we have a long way to go on the public sector within the government world.
Sharon Watkins, thank you so much for joining us. We were happy to have you.
Well, listen, John, I will come on anytime. Thank you so much for being an advocate for whistleblowers.
I really
enjoy your program.
Thank you so much. Last year, according to the big four professional services firm Deloitte, whistleblower complaints in the financial services sector were up 35% over the previous year. One of the things that Deloitte found was that the popular image of a corporate whistleblower is that of an eccentric loner. The truth, however, is more prosaic. Whistleblowers are usually loyal employees. They're passionate about high standards, about ethics, and about the rule of law. They only go outside the chain of command when nobody takes them seriously. They are not defiant troublemakers. They're disappointed believers, and we need more of them. I'm John Kiriakou. Thanks for watching The Whistleblowers. Until next time.